A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been down a rabbit hole. A routine blood test showed mildly elevated unconjugated bilirubin, and his doctor told him it was Gilbert syndrome. Benign, nothing to worry about. But Daniel being Daniel, he started reading, and what he found opened up a whole world. Here's what he wrote to us. During routine blood work, I discovered that I have mildly elevated unconjugated bilirubin caused by Gilbert syndrome, a distinctive but generally harmless inherited condition. Reading about it opened the door to an entire world of genetic variation that I hadn't really appreciated before. Inborn errors of metabolism. Some are essentially benign, like Gilbert syndrome. Others are compatible with a long, productive life if diagnosed and managed. Others are devastating or life-threatening from infancy. I'd like to explore this landscape. First question. When people talk about genetic diseases, are they usually referring to inborn errors of metabolism? Or are IEMs just one relatively small subset within the much broader field of inherited disorders? How are genetic diseases typically classified, and where do IEMs fit into that picture? Second, many IEMs are also classified as rare or orphan diseases, with such tiny patient populations that developing treatments can be scientifically and economically challenging. While healthcare policy deserves its own discussion, he wants to touch briefly on why so many metabolic disorders remain under-researched, and how advances such as gene therapy, enzyme replacement, and newborn screening are changing the outlook. Third, the methylation question. The term appears repeatedly in this field. What does methylation actually mean at the molecular level? Why is it so important in human biology? How many IEMs involve defects in methylation pathways? And how many affect completely different metabolic pathways? He also wants to understand why methylation has become such a popular concept online, and how to distinguish well-established metabolic disorders from claims that go beyond the current scientific evidence. Finally, he wants a tour through the spectrum of inherited metabolic conditions, from relatively common and harmless examples like Gilbert syndrome, through disorders like PKU, to some of the rarest and most severe IEMs, using them as a window into the extraordinary complexity of human metabolism and genetics. That prompt takes us from one person's slightly unusual lab result to the entire architecture of human metabolism. Let's start by mapping the territory.
The first thing to know is that this field essentially begins with one man in 1902. Archibald Garrod was a British physician studying a condition called alkaptonuria, patients whose urine turns black when exposed to air. He noticed it ran in families, and he proposed something radical for the time, that a specific biochemical defect was inherited, and that defect caused the disease. He called it an inborn error of metabolism. It was the first time anyone had linked heredity to a concrete molecular step gone wrong.
Black urine is a memorable entry point.
It really is. And Garrod had this beautiful phrase. He talked about chemical individuality. The idea that each of us has a slightly different biochemical makeup, and sometimes those differences tip into disease. He was a century ahead of his time on that. Now, from that single condition in 1902, we've described approximately 1,450 distinct inborn errors of metabolism. And we're still finding new ones regularly as genomic sequencing picks up variants we didn't know to look for.
1,450. So individually rare, but collectively...
Collectively, they're not rare at all. Depending on the population you're studying, estimates range from about 1 in 800 to 1 in 2,500 live births affected by some form of IEM. That's a substantial number of people. Most of us have never heard of the vast majority of these conditions, but as a category, they touch a lot of lives.
And that's the tension Daniel's getting at. His own condition is benign. A lab curiosity, really. But the same category contains disorders that kill infants within days if they're not caught.
And to answer his first question directly, no, when people talk about genetic diseases, they aren't usually referring specifically to inborn errors of metabolism. IEMs are one subset within a much larger universe. The broad classification of genetic disease typically breaks into four big buckets. You've got single gene disorders, also called Mendelian disorders, where a mutation in one gene causes the condition. IEMs live here, but so do things like cystic fibrosis, sickle cell disease, Huntington's disease. Then you've got chromosomal abnormalities, whole chromosomes missing, extra, or rearranged, like Down syndrome. Third, multifactorial conditions where multiple genes plus environment interact, things like heart disease, diabetes, many cancers. And fourth, mitochondrial disorders which involve mutations in mitochondrial DNA and follow their own inheritance pattern.
So when Daniel's asking whether genetic disease mostly means IEMs, the answer is no. IEMs are a minority within even the single gene bucket.
Right. And within that single gene bucket, IEMs are further classified by the metabolic pathway they disrupt, disorders of amino acid metabolism. PKU is the classic. Disorders of carbohydrate metabolism, galactosemia, where the body can't process galactose. Fatty acid oxidation disorders, organic acid metabolism disorders, lysosomal storage disorders like Gaucher and Fabry, and then disorders of bilirubin metabolism, which is where Gilbert syndrome sits. Each category represents a different stretch of the vast chemical factory that keeps us alive.
Let's sit with Gilbert's for a minute, because it's the anchor of Daniel's question, and it's a perfect illustration of how these things work at the molecular level.
Gilbert syndrome is genuinely elegant in its simplicity. You have a gene called UGT1A1. It codes for an enzyme called UDP glucuronosyl transferase. I'm going to say glucuronosyl transferase once and then never again.
Appreciated.
This enzyme's job is to take bilirubin, which is a breakdown product of hemoglobin, and attach a sugar molecule to it. That process is called conjugation, and it makes the bilirubin water-soluble so your body can excrete it. In Gilbert syndrome, there's a polymorphism, a variation, in the promoter region of the UGT1A1 gene. The promoter is the on-off switch. This particular variation means the switch doesn't work at full power. Enzyme activity drops to about 30% of normal.
30% sounds alarming.
It sounds alarming, but here's the thing. 30% is plenty for normal life. What happens is that unconjugated bilirubin builds up slightly in the blood. It's usually caught on a routine panel where everything else is normal except that one number is mildly elevated, and it can become more noticeable during fasting, illness, stress, or dehydration. But it causes no liver damage, no long-term harm, no reduced lifespan. 3 to 10% of the population has it. Most never know.
So Daniel's lab result is essentially his liver's enzyme working at partial capacity, and that partial capacity is completely adequate, unless you stress the system.
And it's worth knowing about because it prevents unnecessary workups. A doctor who isn't familiar with Gilbert's might see elevated bilirubin and start investigating liver disease or biliary obstruction. Knowing you have it saves you from that cascade.
The benign end of the spectrum, then. Now let's get into the part of Daniel's question that I think trips a lot of people up, the methylation piece. He says the term appears repeatedly, and he wants to know what it actually means, and why it's everywhere online.
This is where we need to make a distinction that most popular discussions completely miss. At the molecular level, methylation is simply the addition of a methyl group, one carbon atom and three hydrogens, CH3, to another molecule. That's it. It's a tiny chemical tag. But what that tag does depends entirely on what it's attached to, and there are two completely different contexts that get hopelessly conflated.
Lay them out. Lay them out.
The first is epigenetic DNA methylation. This is where methyl groups are attached directly to DNA, usually at positions called CpG sites. This doesn't change the genetic code. It changes whether a gene is turned on or off. It's gene regulation. Methylation, at its simplest, is the transfer of a methyl group. That's one carbon atom bonded to three hydrogen atoms, CH3, from one molecule to another. It's a tiny chemical tag. But where you put that tag, and on what molecule, determines everything about what it does.
So it's not one thing. It's a type of chemical reaction that happens in many different contexts.
The two big contexts are DNA methylation and metabolic methylation. DNA methylation is about gene regulation. You attach a methyl group to a cytosine base in DNA, typically at what's called a CpG site, and that generally silences the gene. It's how your liver cell knows to stay a liver cell and not suddenly start expressing neuron genes. It's epigenetic. It doesn't change the DNA sequence, but it changes which genes are accessible. This is intermediary metabolism, and it's where the actual IEMs involved in methylation live.
So when we talk about methylation disorders as inborn errors of metabolism, we're talking about the second kind.
Almost entirely. And here's the key point. The vast majority of IEMs don't involve methylation pathways at all. Amino acid disorders, carbohydrate disorders, fatty acid oxidation disorders, lysosomal storage disorders. None of these are methylation problems. The methylation-related IEMs are a small, specific subset.
Give me examples of the real ones.
Homocystinuria is the classic. It's caused by a deficiency in cystathionine beta synthase, an enzyme that processes homocysteine using, you guessed it, a methyl group transfer. Homocysteine builds up to toxic levels. It causes intellectual disability, lens dislocation, skeletal abnormalities, and a massively increased risk of blood clots. But here's what's remarkable. Many patients respond to high-dose vitamin B6, which is a cofactor for the enzyme, and betaine, which provides an alternative methylation pathway to clear the homocysteine. It's a methylation disorder with a treatment that directly leverages methylation biochemistry.
That's elegant. What else?
True MTHFR deficiency. Not the common polymorphism. I'll get to that. But actual MTHFR deficiency, where the enzyme methylenetrahydrofolate reductase is severely impaired. This is rare and devastating. It causes severe neurological problems, microcephaly, apnea, and could be fatal in infancy. Then there are disorders of creatine synthesis, like GAMP deficiency, guanidinoacetate methyltransferase deficiency, where the body can't make creatine, which is essential for energy metabolism in muscle and brain.
Three rare, severe conditions. Now contrast that with what people actually encounter when they Google methylation.
This is where the wellness industry has built an empire on a misunderstanding. The MTHFR gene has a common variant called C677T. About 10 to 15% of the population is homozygous for it, meaning they have two copies. It reduces enzyme activity somewhat, but it isn't a disease. It doesn't cause the symptoms attributed to it in countless blog posts and supplement marketing materials. You'll find claims that MTHFR variants cause everything from fatigue to autism to depression to infertility, and that you need specialized methylation support supplements to fix it.
And the supplement market is?
Lucrative. Methylated B vitamins, special folate formulations, detox protocols. None of it supported by evidence for people with common polymorphisms. The gap between a true MTHFR deficiency, which is a severe IEM caught on newborn screening or presenting in infancy, and having a C677T variant is the gap between a disease and a normal human variation.
That's the distinction Daniel's asking us to help him make. Establish metabolic disorder versus claim beyond the evidence.
The three criteria are, does it have a clear biochemical phenotype you can measure in a lab? Does it have reproducible diagnostic criteria that aren't just symptom checklists? And are there evidence-based treatments that improve outcomes in controlled studies? Real IEMs check all three boxes. Wellness methylation claims typically check none.
So we've seen the molecular machinery. But knowing what these diseases are raises a harder question. What do we do about them, especially when each one affects only a handful of people?
This is the rare disease economics problem, and it's difficult. Most IEMs affect fewer than 1 in 2,000 people, which is the threshold for what's called an orphan disease. When your potential patient population is measured in hundreds or thousands, the traditional pharmaceutical business model breaks. You can't recoup development costs through volume.
And yet we have treatments.
We do, and the turning point was the Orphan Drug Act of 1983. Before that, there were something like 34 approved orphan drugs total. The act created three incentives: tax credits for clinical research, a period of market exclusivity, 7 years where no competitor could sell the same drug for the same indication, and direct grant funding for development. It worked. We're now at nearly 800 approved orphan therapies.
7 years of exclusivity for a drug that might have no competitors anyway because the market is so small. That's clever incentive design.
It is. But it's also created some perverse outcomes. Companies have learned to slice diseases into ever narrower indications to qualify for orphan status, or to take existing drugs and repurpose them for rare diseases at astronomical prices. The same incentives that brought us enzyme replacement therapy for Gaucher disease also brought us a drug that costs $300,000 a year per patient.
Let's talk about the genuine successes, though. Newborn screening, Daniel mentioned it.
Newborn screening is the quiet revolution in this field. It started with PKU in the 1960s. Robert Guthrie developed a simple bacterial inhibition assay on a dried blood spot from a heel prick. If the baby had PKU, the blood spot would show elevated phenylalanine. It was cheap, it was scalable, and it meant you could catch the disease before irreversible brain damage occurred.
And now?
Now we use tandem mass spectrometry. A single dried blood spot from a newborn's heel can be screened for 30 to 50 conditions simultaneously. The machine measures the mass of molecules in the sample and can detect abnormal patterns of amino acids and acylcarnitines that signal specific metabolic disorders. It's one of the most cost-effective public health interventions ever devised.
PKU itself. Walk me through it as the paradigm case.
Phenylketonuria. Deficiency of phenylalanine hydroxylase, the enzyme that converts the amino acid phenylalanine into tyrosine. Without it, phenylalanine builds up in the blood and becomes toxic to the developing brain. Prevalence is about 1 in 10,000 to 15,000 live births. Before newborn screening, these children develop severe intellectual disability, seizures, and behavioral problems. Now, if you catch it at birth and put the child on a low phenylalanine diet, special medical formulas, carefully measured protein intake, they develop normally.
A dietary disease managed by diet. That's satisfying.
It gets better. There's now a drug called sapropterin, brand name Kuvan. That's a synthetic form of the BH4 cofactor. For some patients with residual enzyme activity, it boosts what little function remains. And there's a newer enzyme substitution therapy called pegvalase that can actually break down phenylalanine in the bloodstream. We've gone from diet alone to a multi-pronged treatment strategy for a disease that was a death sentence for the intellect 60 years ago.
All right, we've covered the classification, the methylation question, the economics. Now let's take the tour Daniel asked for, from the benign to the devastating. Start with Gilbert syndrome.
Gilbert syndrome is caused by a variant in the promoter region of the UGT1A1 gene. UGT1A1 codes for an enzyme that conjugates bilirubin. It attaches a sugar molecule to bilirubin so it can be excreted in bile. The common Gilbert's variant, called TA7, 7TA repeats in the promoter instead of the usual 6, reduces enzyme expression to about 30% of normal. So unconjugated bilirubin builds up mildly in the blood. Before this, the severe forms of Gaucher cause bone crises, massive organ enlargement, and early death. Now patients manage it as a chronic condition.
Infusion every 2 weeks for life.
No liver damage, no progression, no treatment needed. It's so common, 5 to 10% of the population, and so harmless that it's arguably not even a disease. It's a genetic variant. A normal human variant that happens to make your bilirubin run a little high.
So Gilbert's is basically the shallow end of the pool. You get your feet wet, and that's it.
Now step into PKU. PKU is a genuine disease. Left untreated, it causes severe intellectual disability. But it's also one of the great treatment success stories. A low phenylalanine diet starting in infancy, maintained through childhood and ideally for life, allows essentially normal development. Women with PKU who become pregnant need especially careful management because high phenylalanine is toxic to the developing fetus, even if the baby doesn't have PKU. But with good metabolic control, people with PKU live full, productive lives. You need to get the gene to the right tissues. Liver for many metabolic disorders, brain for others, and you need the immune system not to attack the viral vector or the newly expressed protein.
And the economics of a one-time treatment for a tiny patient population.
People with PKU drink a special medical formula that provides all their amino acids except phenylalanine, plus vitamins and minerals. It's restrictive, it's expensive, it's a lifetime commitment. But it works. The payment models are still being invented. Installment plans, outcomes, based pricing, annuity models. It's a fascinating intersection of science, economics, and ethics.
Let's bring this back to what it means for Daniel, and for anyone listening who might have gotten a genetic result they don't know what to do with. You've got Gilbert syndrome. What do you actually do with that information?
When leucine accumulates, it's directly neurotoxic. Without treatment, babies develop encephalopathy, seizures, and death within the first weeks of life. The main practical value is that it explains lab results that would otherwise trigger concern. If you're fasting, stressed, or fighting an infection, your bilirubin might tick up a bit more than usual. That's expected. It also affects the metabolism of a few drugs. Irinotecan, a chemotherapy agent, is the most clinically significant. But for the vast majority of medications, it's irrelevant.
So the intervention is knowledge.
Tell your doctor, have it in your chart, and otherwise forget about it. Compare that to PKU, where dietary management starts in the first week of life and continues indefinitely. Or to maple syrup urine disease, where a misdiagnosis means catastrophic neurological damage within days. Same category, inborn errors of metabolism. But the spectrum of severity is almost incomprehensibly wide.
That spectrum is what I keep coming back to. Gilbert's at 3-10% of the population. Benign. PKU at 1 in 10,000, manageable with early intervention. Then conditions like classic galactosemia, where a newborn given milk goes into rapid decline because they can't process galactose. Liver failure, sepsis, death, if you don't catch it immediately.
Or medium-chain acyl-CoA dehydrogenase deficiency, MKDD, a fatty acid oxidation disorder. These children are perfectly healthy until they have a period of fasting. A stomach bug, maybe, where they're not eating. Then their body tries to switch to fat for energy and can't complete the process. They develop hypoglycemia, vomiting, lethargy, and can die or suffer brain damage. But if you know they have it, you simply make sure they never go more than a few hours without eating, especially when sick. Simple intervention, catastrophic without it.
That's what makes the newborn screening panel so remarkable. A heel prick, a mass spectrometer, and you catch conditions that are invisible until they're emergencies.
And the panel keeps expanding. Different states and countries screen for different numbers of conditions, but the recommended uniform screening panel in the United States now covers something like 35 core conditions and 26 secondary conditions. Every one of those has an intervention that changes the outcome. That's the criterion for inclusion. You don't screen for something you can't treat.
Daniel's final question was about the bigger picture, using these conditions as a window into human metabolism. What's the view?
The view is that human metabolism isn't a single blueprint, it's a distribution. Every enzyme in your body is encoded by a gene, and every gene has variants in the population. Most variants are silent or subtle. Some, like the UGT1A1 polymorphism in Gilbert's, produce a measurable but harmless difference. A smaller number produce disease when you inherit two copies, and a very small number are lethal.
So we all walk around with dozens of minor metabolic quirks?
Hundreds, probably. Most will never know about because they never cause a problem. They're just part of the chemical individuality Garrett talked about in 1902. What shifted is our ability to detect them. Direct-to-consumer genetic testing can now tell you about your MTHFR status, your carrier status for various recessive conditions, your pharmacogenetic variants. The technology has raced ahead of our ability to interpret what it means.
That's where the wellness industry rushes in.
Into the gap between data and meaning. A common polymorphism isn't a disease. A carrier status isn't a diagnosis. A variant of uncertain significance is exactly what it sounds like, uncertainty. But uncertainty doesn't sell supplements. Certainty does, even when it's fake.
So for someone like Daniel, who's gone down this rabbit hole and is trying to sort signal from noise, what's the framework?
First, if you have a specific diagnosis, Gilbert's, PKU, whatever it is, understand what it actually means at the biochemical level, not what a forum says it means. What does the enzyme do? What builds up? What's the consequence? Second, if you're looking at genetic testing results, distinguish between polymorphisms and pathogenic mutations. A polymorphism is common, it's a normal variant. A pathogenic mutation is rare and causes disease. Third, if someone is trying to sell you supplements based on your genetic variants, ask what the randomized controlled trial evidence is. There usually isn't any.
And for Gilbert specifically, Daniel, you're fine. Your liver is just a little lazy at conjugating bilirubin, and 30% capacity is more than enough.
More than enough. And you now have the distinction of carrying one of the most common inborn errors of metabolism in the human species. Wear it as a conversation starter.
Which brings us to the open question. As newborn screening expands and gene therapy advances, our ability to detect and intervene in metabolic differences is going to keep growing. We're going to find more and more conditions that sit in the gray zone, not benign like Gilbert's, not devastating like classic galactosemia, but somewhere in between. Where do we draw the line between variation and disease?
That's the question that's going to define this field for the next generation. Every expansion of the newborn screening panel involves a debate about exactly this. You're identifying children who might never develop symptoms or whose symptoms might be mild, and you're labeling them with a disease. There's a whole category called biochemical phenotypes. You have the lab abnormality, but whether it causes clinical problems is uncertain. We're going to need a much more nuanced language for this.
The boundary between disease and variation is blurring, and we're the ones holding the eraser.
We are. And honestly, I think that's a good problem to have. It means we're seeing human biology at a resolution Garrod could only dream of. The challenge is keeping our interpretation as sophisticated as our technology.
We want to hear from listeners who've discovered their own metabolic quirks, whether it's Gilbert's, a carrier status, or something you're still trying to understand. Send us your stories and questions.
Thanks as always to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, who keeps this operation running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you've got a prompt for us, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.